And I think that's how it can feel for us as Christians. We sense that the water that we're swimming in has changed. Where a decade or so ago, Christians were seen as daggy, sure, out of touch, conservative, religious. But now, with changes around how gender and marriage are viewed, and the spotlight that's shone on institutional child abuse in churches, the rise of the Me Too and the Church Too movements. Well, Christianity isn't merely seen as outdated, but now it's dangerous, destructive, damaging. Something has changed. And as Maria and I found out that morning, swimming against the force of that water, swimming against the current of the culture that we live in, it can become very tiring, can't it? And sometimes it's really hard to navigate and get your bearings right. So how do we conduct ourselves in this new water that we find ourselves swimming in? How do we keep on going when the current is just relentless and against us? Well, today we're going to be spending time with Daniel and his mates. And we're going to be seeing, as we get into this fantastic, rollicking tale, is it really, when we think about it, nothing has changed. Daniel lived 2,600 years ago, and he too had to navigate the tumultuous, choppy waters of living in Babylon as a Jewish exile and follower of Yahweh. He faced enormous threats as he sought to live with courage and conviction in the midst of enemy seas. So what does it look like to speak and act with wisdom and thoughtfulness? What does it look like to be followers of Jesus, faithfully trying to swim in this sea that we find ourselves in? Well, Daniel and his friends, they've gone before us and they've actually got some very encouraging and wise things to teach. So first of all, let's take a look at the book of Daniel as a whole. Let's see how it fits together. So the book has got two main parts. The first part is chapters 1 to 7, and the second part of the book is chapters 8 through to 12. Chapters 1 to 7 are known as the court tales, and they tell the story of Daniel and his friends being taken into exile and living in Babylon, in the courts of the king. And chapters 8 through to 12 are a series of dreams and visions. And today, we'll be focusing on the first part, chapters 1 through to 7. And the first part of this book fits together in a really interesting way. So chapters 2 and 7, they work together as a pair. Chapter 2 recounts King Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue. And chapter 7, that describes Daniel's dream of the four beasts. And these two chapters, they focus on the theme of kingdom. God's kingdom will endure. That's the message of these chapters. So that God's people can actually be patient and can rest, knowing that one day God will make things right. One day God will vindicate the suffering of his people. Then chapters 1, 3, and 6 work together as a triplet, and they offer hope in the face of terrible suffering. And it's this hope that motivates us to keep holding on and to keep being faithful in the midst of hard times. And lastly, chapters 4 and chapters 5, they hang together as well. And they tell us of two arrogant kings, King Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. And through their stories, we're actually reminded that human beings and their kingdoms, well, they become like violent beasts. When they glorify their own power and redefine what's right and wrong, and fail to acknowledge God as the true king. So Daniel 1 to 7, we've got God's enduring kingdom. We've got hope in the midst of hard times, and we've got human kingdoms acting like beasts when they fail to acknowledge God as king. So let's start at the beginning. In chapter 1, we're told, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And according to Nebuchadnezzar's chronicle, this was actually in March 597 BC. And Daniel chapter 1 goes on to say, as we've just heard, the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles of the temple of God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. These were young men, quick to understand and qualified to serve in the king's palace. Well, back in 2019, my husband Clayton and I actually got to go to Jerusalem. He was on long service leave. That was when, you know, you could fly around easily. One of the things that actually prompted us to go to Israel and to Jerusalem was this great book that Clayton was reading. It's actually a biography, not of a person, but of the city of Jerusalem. And it tells the entire story. I mean, Jerusalem has got just such a fascinating history. And this is how this book actually describes this particular siege. So Jerusalem was actually sieged many, many times over its history. And this describes this particular siege that happened here. And it uses parts of the Old Testament. So it says, the famine was sore in the city. Young children faint from hunger at the top of every street. And there were hints of cannibalism. The daughter of my people has become cruel. The hands of pitiful women have sodden their own children. They were their meat in the destruction. Even the rich were soon desperate. They who were brought up in scarlet embraced dunghills, searching for food. People wandered the streets dazed like blind men. Jerusalem suffered the infernal depredations of fallen cities. Those who were killed were luckier than those who starved. Our skin was black like the oven because of the famine. They ravaged the women in Zion. Princes were hanged up by their hands. It's pretty sobering stuff, isn't it? And after the horrors of that siege, about 10,000 nobles and members of the royal family are deported to Babylon. Just try and imagine what that would have been like for them. After months of suffering and the utter devastation of your homeland, you've got to walk across the desert for 4 months on foot. You're taken to a foreign nation where you then stay for the rest of your life. You never go home. A place with a foreign language, with a foreign culture, foreign clothing and traditions and food, and you don't even get to keep your own name. You're now called a name that's strange and unfamiliar to you. And following your God, well, that's now illegal. And to top it off, this nation is ruled by a dictator who, if you get on his wrong side, well, it's just instant death. These are dangerous waters to navigate, aren't they? And straight away in chapter 1, we see Daniel and his mates, they're met with their first challenge. It doesn't take long. As Jews, part of being faithful was keeping the various food laws set down in the Torah. And in verse 8, we're told, Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And this decision, well, it puts Daniel and his friends at risk, doesn't it? Even the Babylonian official, he's scared. He's afraid of what King Nebuchadnezzar will do when he finds out that Daniel and his friends have turned their nose up at the king's food. So straight away we see that Daniel has got to navigate the current that he's in. Straight away he's got to work out where he can be flexible and where he can bend. I mean, he's wearing Babylonian clothes, he's learning the language, he's got a Babylonian name. But he's also got to work out where he's not going to bend and where he needs to hold the line, what he's not going to compromise on. And in this instance, it's the king's food. So this time, in this first one, things go pretty well for Daniel and his buddies. However, doesn't take long, in chapter 3, we see a new challenge arising for Daniel and his friends. So King Nebuchadnezzar sets up an image of gold and he puts it up in the city. We're actually not told exactly what it's an image of. It might be of a Babylonian god, or maybe it's an image of King Nebuchadnezzar himself. But what we do know is this image is big, it's huge. So it's 27 metres high, it's taller than this roof, and it's 3 metres across, like it's large. And King Nebuchadnezzar, he summons all the workers in his government. We heard them read out, didn't we? The satraps, the prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all of the other provincial officials. The entire public service is required to be there, from the most junior intern to the most senior level executive. And they're told, as soon as you hear the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music, you've got to fall down, you've got to worship that image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. So these two long lists, you know, of all the officials and all the instruments, they're actually repeated a couple of times in the narrative, and they sound pretty clunky, don't they? They kind of sound a bit awkward. But, you know, it's a technique that the writer deliberately uses to show us just how all-encompassing this new command was. So everyone in Babylon, whenever they hear any of those sounds, everyone has to stop what they're doing. They've got to drop everything, and they've got to bow down, and they've got to worship that image. It's King Nebuchadnezzar being drunk on his own power. And it's an extreme law with an extreme penalty. But these three Hebrew men, they keep their bearings in those dangerous waters that are swirling around them. Their real names are Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But in Babylon, and in this story, they're known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They don't bow down to the pressure around them, do they? And they don't bow down to this idol. And this creates a major problem for them. They're sentenced to death. In verse 22, we're told that the king's command was so urgent and the flames were so hot that the flames killed, actually, the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I'm wondering whether you've ever sensed a situation feeling urgent and hot. When you've been in a conversation and someone asks, "What do you think about same-sex marriage?" Or someone you know shares with their child starting to identify as transgender. Or with the election coming up, someone says to you, "Isn't Scott Morrison supposed to be a Christian? Aren't you a Christian?" These situations can feel urgent and hot. They're not an actual furnace, but the heat and the immediacy of the situation can take us off guard and leave us fumbling for a wise answer. They can leave us feeling foolish and afraid of saying the wrong thing. And so there's one important thing to remember in the midst of those pressures and in the midst of that struggle. And this story reminds us of it. After Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are thrown into the blazing furnace, King Nebuchadnezzar leaps to his feet in amazement and he asks, "Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" "Certainly," his advisors reply, and the king shouts, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods." One, like a son of the gods, is with them in the furnace. So some commentators actually say that this could be a pre-incarnation appearance of Jesus. We're not exactly sure, but what we do know is this. On this side of the cross, Jesus, the Son of God, he's with you in the furnace. He's with us. He is for us and he loves us. And you know, because he's with us and because he's for us and because he loves us, we can have confidence that he won't abandon us and he won't let us burn. Sure, it's going to be hard. You might even get singed. It might actually be very hard for you right now in the circumstances that you find yourself in. But Jesus, the Son of God, he will not let you go. When you are surrounded by enemies and in the midst of adversity, God is with you. He is for you and he loves you. So we can experiment, can't we, with being bold. we can have courage. We can stand with conviction, even though our legs might be shaking, because he stands with us. In chapter 2, when the wise men of Babylon are asked to reveal the content of the king's dream, they reply, "What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans. But what our God asks us to do, it's not too difficult. It's not too difficult because he knows us. He loves us, and he does live among us." Hundreds of years after Daniel and his friends went through these ordeals, after Jesus had walked on the earth and been crucified on a Roman cross and been raised to life, well, God's people were still facing persecution and suffering. And the Apostle Paul encourages these first century Christians who, like Daniel, are exiles scattered away from their homeland. He says this, "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the fiery trials that you are going through, as if something strange were happening to you. Instead, be very glad, for these trials make you partners with Christ in his suffering, so that you will have the wonderful joy of seeing his glory when it is revealed to the world." And today, in 2022, in Albury, and for all of you on Zoom, this is what he says to us. "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the fiery trials that you're going through, as if something strange were happening to you." But it does feel strange, doesn't it, when we go through trials, when things are just so painful and we actually really don't feel okay. It can feel very strange and we can feel very much alone. And it doesn't very much seem like God is for us. But be encouraged. We walk in the footsteps of many brothers and sisters who have gone before us and they've hung on during tough times. And be encouraged. You are surrounded now, today, by many sisters and brothers who walk alongside you, holding faithfully onto Jesus. So instead, be very glad, for these trials make you partners with Christ in his suffering. In our trials and suffering, we are partners with Jesus, the one who stands with us in the flames. Rosaria Butterfield was a professor in English and Women's Studies at Syracuse University in the States, and she identified as a lesbian. She specialised in queer theory, and she advised the LGBTIQ group at the university. She actually wrote the policy for the uni for same-sex couples, and she actively lobbied for gay rights with her lesbian partner. She was, as you could imagine, strongly opposed to Christians and Christianity. And in 1997, she wrote an article about who she called the religious right, and she wrote about their politics of hatred against people like me. She received lots of letters in response to that article. She actually threw away lots of letters from Christians who were angry and condemning. She even threw away letters from supporters who were like, "Hey, yeah, you go, girl." She threw them all away. But she received one letter from Ken Smith that was different, and she kept that. Ken was a pastor of a church in her local area, and his letter had a peaceful tone and was actually full of compassion and love. And she says that she couldn't throw it away. She kept it on her desk for weeks, and finally her curiosity got the better of her, and she contacted Ken, and he invited her to come over for dinner with his wife. They had many dinners after that and many discussions. They became good friends. And Rosaria, well, she became a Christian. As we read through this story, something that strikes me is how polite Daniel and his friends are to the Babylonians, to people who they could view as enemies. In chapter 1, Daniel resolves not to defile himself with the king's food, So what does he do? He asks for permission not to defile himself. In chapter 2, when Daniel is about to be executed along with the wise men, what does Daniel do? He speaks to Arioch, the king's guard, with wisdom and tact. Wisdom and tact. Be amazing to have that, wouldn't it? And during the interpretation of the dream, Daniel repeatedly calls King Nebuchadnezzar, "Your Majesty." And he speaks with humility. He says, "This mystery has been revealed to me, King, not because I've got greater wisdom than anyone else alive, but so Your Majesty may know the interpretation." He's humble. He's polite. And in chapter 3, when Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, when they stand up to King Nebuchadnezzar and they refuse to bow down to that idol, but they speak with deep courage, they speak with deep conviction, but also politeness. They don't get into an argument, they don't defend themselves, they calmly tell the king that the God they serve is able to deliver them from danger. But even if he doesn't, they will not serve the gods of Babylon or worship the image that the king has set up. Daniel and his friends, they know that their God is with them. And he knows that their God is for them. And so they can stand in the face of hostility with calmness and courage, but also with compassion. So how do we conduct ourselves in this new water that we're swimming in? How do we keep going when the current is just fast against us? Well, we do it with wisdom and tact, with kindness and care. You see, we honour our Heavenly Father, we honour our Heavenly King when we honour those around him who actually don't follow him. So we can resist, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and at times being faithful requires that we do resist. But when we resist, we do it not by defending ourselves or trying to score points, not by insulting other people or by being aggressive and judgmental and critical. Instead, we resist by calmly working out what is right and true and then standing by it with humility and genuine love. Something that's going to help us to do this is remembering that the true King, he's still on his throne. Knowing who we belong to and who is in control can help us to resist while we still honour those around us, even in the face of their opposition. We know that our loving Heavenly Father, he is with us. He is for us and he loves us. And so we too can love other people, even as we do resist. Well, you've probably all heard of cancel culture. It's when a celebrity or a well-known person gets cancelled. They get called out or ostracised because they do or they say something that a whole bunch of other people views as wrong and object to. And it's kind of like what's happening here in this part of Daniel, isn't it? You know, if you don't toe the line, if you don't bow down to the statue, you know, you're literally going to be cancelled. You're going to die. And in this part of Daniel, we can see how kings and kingdoms can get terribly distorted and perverted. And we see that today, don't we? Earthly kingdoms exalting themselves and not acknowledging the true king. And interestingly, ideas and ideologies, I mean, they can be exalted as gods too, can't they? Everyone must bow down to certain ideas and beliefs, otherwise you risk being cancelled and called out. But when we hear about King Nebuchadnezzar's image of gold, hopefully it reminds us of the first place in the Bible where we actually hear about the idea of an image being talked about, way back in Genesis 2. So in Genesis 2, we can see that God, who is the king of the whole creation, he creates humans in his image. And as part of being in God's image, we're given the task of ruling, aren't we? That's part of what that means. But yet, here in Babylon, we actually see that picture being completely corrupted. Instead of honouring the true king, Nebuchadnezzar, on a whim, he demands that he be obeyed or people's lives will end. It's an extreme version of cancel culture going on there, isn't it? And it's almost laughable that these narcissistic antics of King Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 3, well, they actually come straight after chapter 2, where the king learns that although he's that head of gold on the statue, his kingdom is going to pass. And after his reign, another kingdom and another kingdom and another kingdom will come, one after the other. All of them are transient. None of them are going to last. All will be destroyed at some point in history. In Daniel chapter 2, 44, Daniel reveals the ending of the king's dream. We'll hear about that whole chapter being read a little bit later. So he says this in chapter 2. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to other people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it itself will endure forever. You see, God is the true king, and he is on his throne. He has established his kingdom, and it will last forever. It's not just some Game of Thrones, you know, with a whole bunch of people vying for power. We're not sure who will end up on top. No. God has established his kingdom, and it will last forever. And how has God done this? Well, not by being a power-hungry tyrant who, you know, rules with violence and bloodshed. God has crushed all those earthly kingdoms and he will bring them to an end. But, you know, he's done this by allowing his own son to be crushed. So when did Jesus first sit on God's enduring throne? Well, it was when he was nailed to that cross, wasn't it? And when did Jesus first wear God's kingly crown to usher in the kingdom? It was when that crown of thorns was shoved upon his head. Because this is the kind of kingdom that our God has ushered in. Jesus reigns as an eternal king, and he's given up everything for his people. We don't have a king who's a power-hungry tyrant or a dictator. We don't have a king who wakes up in a bad mood and people's whole lives are cancelled and destroyed. We don't have a king who pokes us when we're down and just tells us to get over it and try harder when we're struggling. Instead, we've got a king who is for us. We've got a king who loves us. We've got a king who's with us. He's one who comes alongside us in the hardest, hottest furnace that you could ever find yourself in. And that changes everything, doesn't it? Swimming against the rip, it's hard, it's tiring. Sometimes we just want to stop swimming and just let it take us along. But our loving king tells us in the book of Isaiah. He says, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The fire will not set you ablaze. Well, here's a picture of my dog, Harley. There he is. We got him about a year ago. I admit he was a pandemic dog. He's the first dog that we've ever owned. And me and my husband, we love going to the beach. So that's why I'm a dog person and a beach person, my two favourite things coming together. And, you know, we let him off the lead and we watch him race about. And he's just really funny. He's got this funny little habit of coming and actually standing right in between me and Clayton when he feels worried or when he feels afraid. And the other day, you know, he got into a bit of a scrap with this French bulldog called Boo, who was actually very small, but Harley's not particularly brave. So he scampers back and he actually comes right between me and Clayton, right there, and he stays close. And then he comes and, you know, he starts trotting along with us. He's close, he's safe, he's secure. And then he'll bound off again and he'll get caught up in all sorts of scraps and chaos. You see, he comes to us for shelter. He comes to us to know that he is safe. And knowing that, well, that enables him to go and do bold, brave, and crazy things. And that's the same for us, right? How do we conduct ourselves in this new water that we're swimming in? How do we keep going with courage and conviction when the current is against us? Well, we come to God for shelter. We take our refuge in Him. He is our safe place to come and just stand here. And knowing that He is our refuge, our shelter, our safe place, our home, well, that enables us to go out and do bold, brave, and crazy things. God is our loving King of the universe, and He's on His throne. He hasn't left us. He's not threatened. He's not fearful. He's not overwhelmed by the complexities of our culture. And He stands with us, and He's ready. Thank you.